I'm Larry Rasmussen, and this is another session in the series on ethics. The focus today is on moral decision-making, and most of the discussion will be on the factors in moral decision-making. There are five of them. The five of them are always present in any decision on a moral issue that you may make. The five factors are an analysis of the empirical situation. The second one is the factor of moral norms. We all bring moral norms to any decision. Third factor is that each of us has a method or a process of decision making on moral issues, and that is a factor that we're going to discuss later this hour in some detail. The fourth factor is that we all bring fundamental beliefs and commitments to any decision, or you could state it differently, we have our ultimate concerns and convictions that we bring. And then the fifth factor is that we bring character traits. We all have personality factors, matters of personal style that do affect the decisions we make. I want to take the first, until 9:30 or so, if it takes that long, to talk about this chart, and then at 9:30 I want us to do something a little bit on the order of what we did last time. Not a debate per se, but I will share with you three approaches to decision making, this factor down here, method or process, and then you will talk about the pros and the cons of each of those approaches. Now, let's look at the chart. All of these factors are in each moral decision you make. They're in each moral decision that anybody makes. However, folks aren't always aware of those factors, and thus they often overlook the influence of each. And here again, people tend to be, to use that word, reductionist about what's going into a moral decision. I've been on many church convention floor when someone goes to the mic and says, "If you only knew the facts in the case, then they would tell you what moral stance the church ought to take. If you only knew the facts, then you'd your stand would be such and such on the issue of abortion, for example." Not true. The facts may make a difference, but you and I and everyone else may even agree on the significant facts and have very different stands on the issue at hand. That person has only stipulated one of the factors and has made the mistake of thinking that that is the only salient factor and that everything else is a given. Or the same church convention debate may have another person going to the mic and saying, "If we really believe that God is love, then..." And then out rolls the moral stand that we should all take. That person has located one of the factors, namely some significant fundamental belief or conviction, and is properly aware that that factor is important to the decision, but has made the mistake that that factor alone decides. None of these factors alone decides any person's decision. So when someone says, "If you only knew the facts in the case, then," or "If you really believe that God is love, then," or name any other single one, you know that that person is not reflecting all the factors even in that person's decision. Okay, let me say a word about the fact that these factors can influence one another. If I see the same conditions day in and day out, if I see, for example, conditions of poverty and hunger, my moral norms might well be affected by the empirical setting, by the situation that I'm in. For example, I may have come into that setting in which the most important moral norms that mattered to me were matters of, say, personal integrity, honesty. But if I'm working in a situation of just compelling poverty, it may well be that before long, the moral norms that become most important in my ranking of the moral norms I hold are such as justice, or maybe now civil liberty, which I brought into those conditions of poverty, won't matter as much as equality. So the situation in which I find myself or I move into can affect my moral norms. If I take a job and work in prisons, and it's let's say it's in an authoritarian state, then it may not be long before civil liberty and freedom move very high on my scale of moral norms, and maybe charity is not hold the place that it once did. The empirical situation can affect my moral norms. But the reverse is also true. If I come to a setting, a situation, a case at hand, with, say, a conviction that justice is a strong moral norm for me, let's say justice as equality, then my reading of the salient facts in the case is going to be affected by the moral norms that I bring to it. What I understand to be the significant facts will reflect the moral norms I bring. A socialist norm of equality, for example, reads the present-day international economic order differently from a capitalist norm of freedom. It's the same international economic order, but ask a socialist or a capitalist what's important about it, and you'll get two different answers. Why do you get two different answers? Not only two different answers, you'll get two different readings, even looking at the same order. Because the capitalist will bring a moral norm of freedom, which is different from the socialist moral norm of equality, and that will be the grid through which the situation is itself interpreted. Some facts are more important than other facts. There is always that kind of selection, and the moral norms will make a difference. And you get a different interpretation then of the facts. Even different facts are found, so to speak, or selected. So I'm saying that, just to choose a couple of examples here, that the analysis of the situation can affect my moral norms. The reverse might be the case. You can go anywhere you want around that chart, and the factors will influence one another as well as influence the decision. Take a look at fundamental beliefs and commitments. If my strongest attachments change, if the loyalties in my life alter, say I marry or I unmarry, or I change careers, or I choose a very different place to live and work, that will likely change some of my basic beliefs. It might well change some of my moral norms. My character might be altered, etc. So there are just a lot of things. Now, I put up in the corner the tilt of character traits, or people's personality. That means that two people or two groups who say agree on all of these other factors, because they have a different personality, that factor in itself, even when they share basic beliefs, share the same basic method of making moral decisions, share common moral norms, read the situation the same way, they still may act different, decide and act differently. I had a college roommate once who felt much the same way I did. It wasn't Nyla, incidentally. And we shared values, outlooks, made decisions in much the same way. We often acted differently and even decided differently on moral issues, because he was very passionate about deciding and acting now. He was just a bundle of impatient energy, and I was much more given to deliberation and calculation, and we often ended up in the same place, except that I was always generally behind him, and I would make a decision on that issue and he'd be off to another decision, and sometimes we would decide differently. It was just style that rooted in personality, and I'm saying that too can be a factor. So, all of these, or each of these, is independently influential on your moral decision. Each can also affect the other. They are always, always present, all of them. I hope now you can see why it is that Christians may disagree with one another wildly on moral matters, and at the same time may well line up on a moral decision in the same camp with non-Christians of varied persuasions. Let me check that out with you. Does the chart help you see or explain why it is that Christians may vary widely on any given moral issue and find themselves standing with others, together with others in some and not together in others? Anything you want to discuss about the chart or about that
factor?
Would
you say there's anything that is unique to being a Christian that is not subject to those, I mean, that would be agreed upon by all Christians, that wouldn't be subject to that kind?
Try it again, John.
I'm thinking it through as I'm asking it.
Yeah.
Well, would there be anything that you would see as a common position or denominator among Christians that wouldn't vary with every personality and every...
Oh, I think there's much shared. I think that there... I don't think you have unlimited moral norms, for example, among Christians. I think some would be there as an expression of Christian faith. I think some fundamental basic beliefs and commitments would be there. We started talking about some of those even yesterday in Dan's Bible study session, what those might be.
But how they play into decision making would always be influenced by all the factors.
Yeah, and so you don't know whether what is held in common is going to make for a commonly held position on a moral matter. It's important because it's both important to say yes, these things are held in common and they do influence a decision. If you do believe God is love, that matters. Or if you do believe, take some of these fundamental beliefs and commitments, that history is going somewhere, there are grounds for hope because of the destiny of the world in God's hands. That matters. You know, it can matter for a moral decision. At the same time, the fact that you've got these different factors means that people can disagree on a moral issue on the basis of only one difference of factor. I'm going to share the others.
Wait. Yeah.
I realize that not everyone's reading the politics of Jesus, but it would be a good point at which at least part of his premise would be tested by your chart. For instance, there's a section where he shows how mainstream Christianity has set aside Jesus as normative for ethics and says that by and large the church has gone to natural theology or the nature of things rather than a norm that has been revealed in Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
If I understand the chart, you're saying that you cannot choose between revelation in Jesus Christ and the nature of things. Is that so that I think he says in answer to Janet, yes, there are some things, as soon as you make a commitment to Jesus Christ, that are given that override the tilt, the analysis, the moral norms, but your chart would say you can't get away from those other things on the chart.
Yoder would disagree with some of the source of the moral norms and some particular moral norms.
I see.
See, if you go to looking at the way things are, natural,
yeah,
picking your moral norms from that, you'll get some moral norms from some sources. And he wants to say, don't do that, look to Jesus,
okay,
and in Jesus you'll get some particular moral norms.
Right.
So there's some disagreement there. But see, Yoder and I and you and anybody else in this room might even agree on the moral norms,
yeah,
that we see in Jesus. And still we may not agree on the issue of abortion or Central American policy. And it may be because we have different understandings of what in fact is going on. Although the fact that we do share those moral norms is going to be a strong factor tilting us toward common decision.
Does Yoder make allowance for the analysis of empirical situational data? This is one of my questions I've
been
reading.
Yeah.
Because one of the concerns I have is whether you make an explicit allowance for it or not, that all of us come from a particular root of mode of experience that's rooted in either being male or female, or black or white, or wealthy or poor, so we all bring to it a certain way of looking things and analysis of empirical data, whether we consciously
yeah
do that or not. And I don't see allowance for that in Yoder's
methodology. That's an interesting comment. You'd be in a better position than I. He would certainly agree that we bring analyses of empirical situation, even if they're assumed, even if they're because of the particular perception we have as male or as white or as poor or as rich, etc. He would certainly concede that. I mean, his whole point of having to read historical documents historically, don't bring your questions first, but try to get inside what you did yesterday on hermeneutics, is a part of this factor. So he's certainly giving room for that. But you may be right that he's not giving sufficient room for those factors or thinks they need to be overridden by a revealed set of norms. Incidentally, people don't often, or put it this way, people always have their reading of a situation that's influential. They don't always say what it is, and they don't have to, but they always bring it. I mean, most of our decisions, we just assume that the same thing is going on the last time we came up against that decision, unless we see something different in it. And on some decisions, you don't have to know everything in detail. The pacifist, in deciding his or her participation in war, simply needs to know whether a war is going on. I mean, you don't have to know a whole lot about it. Because of that conviction and those moral norms, you just have to ascertain whether this is a situation where the taking of human life is a matter of the issue at hand.
So, Larry, are you saying, I mean, you're not, but are you saying that there is no situation or decision that is given because of being a Christian? I mean, maybe the norms might be given, but never the decision.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. what's understood to be the decision given would have to be because it was an answer to each of those factors. And they are separate variable factors. I also hope that as you get into more of the biblical studies, that this illumines what New Testament scholars are telling us more and more every day, that the New Testament writings reflect very different situations. And those, whether it's a letter to the Ephesians or to the Romans or Timothy, or whether it's the Gospels of Mark or Matthew or John, they're written out of and to communities struggling with different issues. And you need to understand that if you're going to understand the variety of material there. Why, for some, the fundamental beliefs and commitments and understandings of God and moral norms are different than for others in the New Testament itself, much less but the Old Testament. So this is an effort to not only illumine, I hope, the factors in your decision-making, but to show why you get such a pluralism of decisions on moral issues. Now, what I want to spend our time with today, the rest of the time, is this one factor, the method of making a decision on a moral issue, the process. That came up in our debate last time between Grant and Gilkey. Gilkey was contending that what counts most in determining what is moral, in this case deciding about the distribution of Red Cross parcels, is the outcome of the decision. What counts most are the consequences for the people involved. Grant, however, said what counts most is people freely making their choices. We got into a good debate, and you know that there's more to it than just that. But just those factors alone, if you said what counts most are the consequences, someone else said, no, what counts most is free choice, you already got a different approach. It's going to make for a different outcome. If you've read the book, Lest Innocent Blood Be Shed, you have with André Trochme a third approach, which is both different from Grant and from Gilkey. Trochme, for him, what counts most is that certain fundamental duties are moral laws, not be violated. No matter what you do, you can't kill, you can't take life. And what counts most is that certain fundamental, really fundamental obligations be met. Namely, you do what you can to reduce evil in the world. Now, if you understand your whole approach in terms of not violating certain fundamental duties and then fulfilling certain other fundamental obligations, that determines your approach. That's different from what are likely to be the consequences in this situation, or is it freely made? So there are different methods of decision making. Grant, Gilkey, and Trochme have different ways of making moral decisions, and the ways often lead to different decisions. I think that if you took the same situation that you get in the book Lest Innocent Blood Be Shed, when Trochme and his friends are taken into the concentration camp, and they can leave if they will just sign an oath of allegiance to the Vichy government, and Trochme says no. And the inmates in the concentration camp said, you're crazy. You can get out of here if you just put your name on the line. Trochme says he can't, and he didn't, and they weren't released. If Gilkey had come to that same situation, from what we know from Shantung Kapan, his approach would have been, what are the overall consequences of signing or not signing this oath? And which are preferable? Signing it or not signing it, morally preferable in terms of the consequences. My guess is that Gilkey would have signed it. Trochme wouldn't have, because they have different methods of moral decision making. There are two factors: what counts most as moral, what qualities matter in determining what is most, and then the specific procedure or process itself. Okay, for the rest of the time this morning, I'm going to describe three major methods of moral decision making. I'm going to bet 2 days of dish team that each of you falls into one of those three.
Who are you betting, Larry?
Everybody, yeah. If I lose. If you don't fall into one of these three in a clear-cut fashion, it's only because your method of moral decision, method of making a moral judgment, no, not wrong, it's some combination of the three, so I still win the bet. I'll briefly describe each of them, and then what we'll do is assess together each one in turn. What are the pros and the cons, and the strengths and the weaknesses? What is the fatal flaw in each of them? And maybe another prefatory remark: Christians have exhibited these three kinds, and I would say at the same time that there isn't any consensus that one of them, or a particular combination of the three, is the Christian method of moral judgment, which is another reason why Christians don't end up agreeing, because they have different approaches in just this one factor. Okay, first, general approach to moral decision making is what might be called consequences ethics. There's very widespread use of this as a matter of way of making moral decisions. The question is, how do I decide what to do, or how do we decide what to do? And in this mode, that's answered by saying, well, see what the consequences are of possible alternative actions, and then choose the best possible of those possible alternatives. We Americans think that's a very common sense approach, but that's because this culture is soaked in a particular version of consequences ethics called utilitarianism, where you try to calculate the greatest good for the greatest number, and what that greatest good for the greatest number is then tells you what moral decision to make in the case at hand. Now, two factors then in this way of doing ethics. One, you've got to have some norms by which you can see what's good, by which you understand how you'd even recognize the greatest good. Greatest good in light of what? So then there your moral norms come in, the moral norm of love or of justice or of equality or freedom or of honesty or whatever they are. And then secondly, you've got the actual calculation of the probable consequences of various decisions and courses of actions. I'll just warn you that many people are so accustomed to this way of doing it that they don't have a very clear sense of what their norms are for calculating the greatest good for the greatest number. It's just kind of self-evident to them that one course of action is better than another, but they don't. It's because they assume the moral norms rather than state them. Let me give you a couple instances of ethics, Christian ethics, done in this manner, where people are explicit about their moral norms. We mentioned one at the very outset of our sessions, namely Joseph Fletcher's book, Situation Ethics. In that book, which is straight out utilitarian Christian ethics or consequences ethics, he says, you simply take the norm of agapeic love, a self-giving love, and you ask yourself, now in this situation, which consequences are most loving? Which decisions and actions will produce results that are most in keeping with, or most embodying of love? He just calculates as best he can all the consequences of different contemplated actions, and then he asks which is the most loving. In the case of Frau Bergmann in the concentration camp and knowing of her family back in Berlin and knowing the only way she can get out is by becoming impregnated, being released, he says the question is not, is this adultery or not? Fletcher says, wrong question. The question is the most loving, what is the most loving act that the situation permits? And he concludes the most loving act is the reuniting of the family, and then it was right that Frau Bergmann was impregnated by a guard in the camp for the purpose of being reunited with her family. Or to take a different example of consequences ethics, it's liberation theology ethics. By and large, our consequences ethics. And this mode of liberation, they've got a different standard now. It's some notion of liberation. And the question is, what is then for people the most liberating course of action that the situation permits? You have to ask now what liberation means. It usually means that which expands individual group power and individual and group choice for shaping their own setting. Or differently, and I hear it all the time, that which increases taking our own lives into our own hands. That which enhances taking control of our lives. That's the moral norm. Or another way in which it's often said, that which decreases dependency upon others who are more powerful than we. That's all a kind of norm of liberation. And the way of making the decision is, what do we then do which will, in keeping with that norm, what course of action do we take? And that course of action which produces consequences in keeping with that norm, then, is the way to go. Okay, that's the mode of consequences ethics. Now, do you want to discuss the pros and cons of each as we go, or do you want me to sketch the other two and then come back?
Yeah.
All right. Another one, is what's sometimes called duty ethics. There's a long word for it, deontological ethics, but stick with duty ethics. People who hold to duty ethics, like André Trocmé, in a certain sense John Yoder, although John Yoder's is a combination here. Trocmé is more straightforward duty ethics. They don't really say consequences don't count, don't matter. I don't know anybody that says that. But they say that there are some factors in our decision making that are so important that you must always take those factors into account and let them shape whatever action you take. Indeed, shape the consequences themselves. If I were a friend of a dying person who asked me to check to see that all of his affairs were in order, the will was in order, all of the arrangements have been made for the funeral, etc. I went and did that. The next time I saw him in the hospital and it says dying days, he says, have you done that? And I said, yes. Did you check everything? I said, yes. Will you promise me that you'll check one more time? And I said, okay, I grant last wishes, of course. And then later that day, he dies. I know everything's in order. Okay? Now, should I check one more time or shouldn't I? Consequences are exactly the same. I'm certain of that. It doesn't matter whether I check or don't check. Should I carry through, check or not? If you're a duty ethics person, you say you keep your promises. And promise keeping ought to qualify every decision you make. Or now stipulate some other fundamental obligations. A pacifist says, under no condition do you take human life, any human life. So that any consideration of any consequences has to be in accord with that qualifying obligation or that qualifying duty. So a duty ethics person is one, or an obligation ethics person, is one that says some particular values rank more highly than others and have a privileged place in the moral life. Or some values are absolutely basic and must regulate all of our choices and actions. Some values impose fundamental obligations upon us, and you should never choose actions or courses of actions which violate those basic values, those basic duties, even if you could plausibly argue that violating those duties would result in the greatest good for the greatest number. Consequentialists, straight consequentialists would say, violate them if the total overall outcome is a balance of good over evil. Duty ethics person says, no, you don't violate them. Even if plausibly you can talk about a greater balance of good over evil. You don't, for example, violate someone else's dignity, even if for the majority you could plausibly argue that violating the dignity of that individual would result in a greater good. That's a duty ethics person.
So the strict duty ethics person, to take the classic example, would not be able to kill Hitler, say.
If he's a pacifist, okay, or she's, yeah, a pacifist. Now the duties may change. I'm not saying don't read into this a certain set.
Okay.
Don't read into this a certain set. People can have different duties. I'm saying the method, the approach, is the same for all duty ethics persons, and that approach matters in the decision making. If you want the classical formulation of it, it's Immanuel Kant's ethics. That's the classical formulation of it. That's why the question for this session, should Dick and Jane bother to tackle the categorical imperative? Duty ethics person says, yes, Dick and Jane certainly ought to. Kant, I'll just cite the second formulation of the categorical imperative. So act in every case as to treat humanity, whether in your own person or that of another, as an end and never a means only. Kant says, whatever decision you're making, never decide in a way that treats people only as means and not also as ends. Kant would agree with the consequentialist ethics person that the greatest good for the greatest number should be striven for, but he would say not if the proposed course of action to attain that overall good violates the basic human dignity of some people in the process. If a minority were treated as means only for the good of a majority, Kant would say no to that proposed decision and course of action because it violates a certain obligation that you never treat people as means only. Doesn't mean you don't treat them as means, but never as means only, but also as ends. That's just an example. I suppose the easiest, since you're reading The Politics of Jesus, many of you, the easiest place to see this is in John Yoder's case. for pacifism. It's an example of duty ethic, or in Trochmes. Lots of Christians have been in this camp. In fact, if you ask the average pew sitter what Christian ethics is, the average pew sitter often stipulates certain basic obligations that we have, maybe in the form of the Ten Commandments, maybe in the form of the Sermon on the Mount, but it's very often a set of obligations that are fundamental and that then qualify any contemplated decision or action. Okay, finally then, a third approach, also shared by many Christians, is character ethics. Consequences ethics, duty ethics, character ethics. Here the focus is on the kinds of persons or the kinds of society that you want in terms of the qualities of that person and society. Consequences ethics, a la Gilkey or anyone else, is trying to look at objective outcome of an action. Character ethics wants to look at what qualities are fostered in people and in the society. So it's the attention to the moral agent rather than the act. It's attention to the quality and character of the decision maker rather than the particular elements of the decision and action itself. Now there's an assumption in this tradition of thinking, and that assumption is that acts, what people do, decide and do, express the kinds of persons that they have become and are becoming. So character is the wellspring of action, and then it's character that counts most of all. Good trees bear good fruit. So things like moral nurture take on great importance, and a look at people's dispositions, motives, intentions, attitudes, all of those elements of character, the inner life of a person or a society, is what is attended to. Beliefs, perspectives, ideals held. It's the good person or the good society that is the center of attention. And you then consider your action or your decision and your action on the basis of consequences, but consequences for the kind of person or society that you want to see. You understand the decision difference between attention to consequences here and the first one?
Not sure I do.
If I'm contemplating a decision or an action and doing character ethics, I will contemplate consequences, but it will be with an eye to what do those consequences mean for the
action.
For the what?
For the action that will result from it.
No, that's consequences ethics.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, but I'm for character ethics. It's for the consequences for what kind of people.
I was going to say, like, would an example be if you can free a society, but the only way you can, or if you can liberate a society, but the only way you can liberate and maintain it is by arming all the people.
Yeah.
A character ethics would say, to the character of those people is greater than the good.
They will just ask the question. What? Not the question, is the society then going to be liberated, but what does liberation mean in terms of the kind of people that you're going to have from bearing arms and engaging in a struggle? Yeah, Grant was coming from that perspective. Grant was saying the question is not will everyone be fed in terms of some objective outcome? The question is, what kind of persons do you want in this decision? And he was trying to say, you want to nurture responsibility, or one could make the case for him, you want to nurture responsibility, you have to have free choice, so people ought to be able to make those decisions themselves, and that will produce the kind of people, rather than people being forced to do something by some other agent. That would be, if that's an accurate judgment, that's a difference between the kind of consequence of ethics with the black community in mind and King of Moral Character ethics with the whole society in mind. Now, King himself, however, his ethics were a combination of really duty ethics and character ethics, because King was convinced that there is a moral universe, that there are moral laws, and that whatever course of action you contemplate, don't violate those moral laws. And one of those moral laws is that you don't violate any human's dignity. I mean, his is a combination of the latter two. He cared about consequences, wanted good consequences, but the consequences themselves had to line up with the character of the society that you wanted to produce, and that qualified them. And the character of that society was told you by that which lined up with the moral law. There, with him, you have an example of a combination here. So consequences ethics has its focus on action that realizes good ends that are stipulated, and then you have certain norms for deciding that. Duty ethics has its focus on fundamental binding obligations in the moral life that would qualify any decision or action contemplated. Character ethics has its focus on really the traditional language is on virtue, that is to say, on the qualities of the person or the society that you want to see realized. Those are three quite different approaches, if you just as separate. Doesn't mean you can't combine them. My guess is that you can't think of a fourth that's different than that. If you think of a fourth, my guess is that it's really some combination of these. Now, I could test that. If there's something that leaps to mind as a different matter.
How about the immediate mad simply does not make a
moral decision? Doesn't do what?
Doesn't make a moral decision.
Tell me who that is. I want to see the person who doesn't make moral decisions. Huh?
Someone who would be, like, I think
it's
my thing, strictly
utilitarian, you know? No, I think it's more of like the stranger, you know, and like Camus, you know, the person who simply acts without, seemingly without contemplation.
Well, there are many people who act without contemplation, but it's very likely that they still express.
Would you think that the stranger expresses?
Well, I don't know. That's a good question. There are also, I'm certainly not, I mean, my statement was a little too global. There are people who are amoral. There are people who have many methods of moral judgment, and they hop among them. this maybe sounds neater than a lot of folks are. But if you want to talk about most people.
I mean, it implies an assumption of ability to, or capability to be a moral agent.
Yeah.
With some people.
Yeah.
Mental, whatever.
Yes. When we didn't talk about that because we ran out of time earlier, but in the book Comparative Religious Ethics by Little and Twiss, they make a helpful distinction. They say all people are recipients of moral decisions and actions, but not all people are moral agents, and that's correct. You don't expect Claire Martin to make to be a moral agent, to make to make moral decisions. She makes them, maybe, but at least you're going to have a veto power there.
Or people who are severely mentally handicapped. I mean, there is an assumption of a modicum of rationality and capacity to decide or act here. So you're right. This assumes moral agency. Yeah.
I was sort of hearing a distinction amongst the methods of one and two sounds like the actors and three sounds like the recipient.
No.
That you saw that as a projection of the person making the action and not as something that's inflicted upon those who are being morally decided over.
I'm talking about people in all cases making decisions. And I'm just saying character ethics person makes the decision with an eye to what qualities are fostered in that person and others. Everybody. Well, but in any case, we're talking about make the person who is making the decision. And the outcome pertains also to others in each case, but we're talking about the decision making itself. All right, time is fugiting here. As Kempis does, and pardon, I got my Latin mixed up there. Kempis is fugiting, is what I was trying to say here. Yes. Let's go back and ask about the pros and cons of each of them. It's depressing when you read and teach ethics because you find out they all have fatal flaws, and that's a little hard on your own method of moral decision making. Well, let's find out what those fatal flaws are. What about consequences? What strengths and weaknesses do you see in that approach? Dan? Yeah.
Know whether they're going to be good or not.
Yeah. That's the most important one. As a mark against it, it assumes actually there are two things there. It assumes, number one, that you can adequately calculate the consequences, and it assumes that you have some kind of control on your act once it's made. So that contemplated effect comes about. Mary?
Well, duty ethics would seem to me not to take into consideration a changing cultural acceptance of things. And maybe it's the culture that's wrong and that the ethics have to stay the same, but that's the question I have. Just take divorce.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at one point you would never, as a Christian, make an ethical decision to divorce. Now it is simply accepted. Well, would the duty person then continue to adhere to the way that you make the decision doesn't change maybe scripturally or faith, and yet maybe you just have to re-examine again what you thought was an absolute. I mean, there just doesn't seem to be any absolutes to me anymore about anything.
Including not taking human life?
Well, I'd like to say yes, that's the one thing that I think of. But then you come to places where maybe that's necessary.
Yeah. Namibia. A duty ethics person is probably going to be of the mind that no matter how much cultures change, there are some requisites for living together, for making society possible. So that person is going to be one who you're going to have to prove, make a very strong case that fundamental obligations can change. Now, a duty ethics person doesn't necessarily say that my understanding of what those fundamental obligations are can't be changed. It may come to a different stand on, for example, divorce.
You could still be a duty ethics person and change your mind. Only you would have to say that you have to just make a strong case for that. You see what I mean? To talk about fundamental values, fundamental obligations, doesn't have to fix things forever as entrenched absolutes. You can also, as a duty ethics person, have a notion there are such fundamental duties or obligations, and there can be exceptions to them, but the burden of proof is on anyone who wants to change them. For example, my basic stance might be a pacifist stance, and then I would come to any situation and I would have, that would orient my decision. If someone were able to make a very strong case why there should be a highly exceptional taking of human life under these circumstances, that could still be a duty ethics person.
But then you slipped over into situation ethics?
No, you haven't slipped over into situation ethics. You've just distinguished between rule and exception, between fundamental obligation.
So is it the culture that makes you give the exception for the situation, the circumstance, and not your basic thinking? I mean, why is that person changing his or her mind? What would cause you to do that?
Usually it's because of a conflict or competition among or between fundamental obligations. Here's the duty ethics approach. In order for us to carry on having life together at all, we're going to have to fulfill some basic obligations. We're going to have to tell the truth to one another. If I can't assume that we're telling the truth, you know, we can't do anything. You ask me what time it is, I tell you two different times. We say, what time do we eat? And we come and there's no food prepared. If we can't simply proceed with truth telling, we can't live together. If we don't keep promises, version of that, we can't live together. If we don't assume some dignity of each other, we can't live together. If we don't assume that our life isn't threatened at every moment, we can't live together. Well, there are just all kinds of things. All right, there may come some situations where several of those are in conflict with one another. In that kind of circumstance, which is a circumstance of war, for example, then you may be able to make a case for me that I have to temporarily set aside my fundamental commitment not to taking another person's life in order to establish those conditions where that can again be the rule, a struggle for liberation is an example of such a situation. Do you see that the approach is that there are basic rules or obligations, principles, not to be violated. They have the status of, people call it an absolutist position, it's not a good word, but fundamental obligations. Some of those may come into conflict with one another, and you may be able to show circumstances which arise, which say that you're going to temporarily make an exception. A duty ethics person would say, careful when you make it, because that which is an exception can easily be written into standard morality. That's what John Yoder says happened in the just war theory. It became easy to take life once a just war was a way of declaring when you could legitimately take another human life as a rare moral exception to the fundamental rule that you never take human life. And it before long became an ethic which allowed you to take human life relatively easily instead of a rare moral exception. In the book
let the Shantung compound, remember the scene between two generations, the father told the son that stealing from the Japanese in the compound was okay. The son, who grew up in Shantung compound, decided that stealing was okay. They had a problem on their hands because he stole not just from the Japanese. And the father said, well, I meant you only steal and only steal from the Japanese. You can't steal from anybody else. That's not moral. Son didn't understand the difference between exception, just the rule on stealing, and the rule itself. Well, the duty ethics person is worried about that. Do you want to say anything more about consequences ethics, pros and cons of that method?
There's a tape where Yoder analyzes Bonhoeffer's decision to be part of the plot.
Yeah.
Which is interesting how he talks about how the consequences really were under control and weren't anywhere near, but the consequences were assumed in the moral decisions.
Yeah. Yeah. That is again part of the same criticism, and I think it would be good tape to listen to on this criticism of can you calculate the consequences adequately, and can you control the consequences of your decision. If you can, that's a rather severe indictment against using that. That's the most American ethic, cost-benefits analysis, utilitarian ethics. There's another one that I want to at least raise. Are you, as a moral agent, doing ethics in this mode, accountable for the unforeseen or unintended consequences, as well as for the intended and predicted ones?
It seems like, especially when you talk to military people, that the idea that you can control because that's what's supposed to happen is certain things. It's an absolute facade that there's always going to be unforeseen factors that there's no way you could control all of them.
Uh-huh.
I was going to say, I guess it's because we probably all work out of that framework so easily, but because it's also that analysis or argument is used against people that we oppose. I think a classic example is the Soviet Union. People say, yeah, the revolution had good intentions, good ideals, but look what happened. It couldn't control it. Evil was caused. It works out of the same kind of framework. And then they use that as a cautionary excuse to say, let's prevent that from ever happening. That's what always happens in Marxist.
Uh-huh.
It has that same kind of analysis.
Yeah.
And here, I mean, when it's on our side, we say, yes, we have the control and the power to make the consequences come out the way we want them. When it's somebody against us, they can say, no, once they started to get out of hand, Nicaragua will start to hold on to us.
Mm-hmm.
It's a double standard in how we employ that.
Yeah, it's the same approach, but it's a double standard.
Yeah, same approach,
but it's
the same assumptions and framework.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, since it's about coffee break time, let's just take a minute at least for the other couple. What about the pros and cons of duty ethics? Mary raised one, and that is whether in fact fundamental obligations are in enduring matters, or if they aren't subject to a kind of moral relativism. Can you really stipulate basic fundamental moral obligations?
I'm finding it hard to think of what would be fundamental apart from whatever you get from your culture growing up. Because they would always be different with different kinds of people.
Well, is that true? Why have most societies legislated some version or another of the second table of the Ten Commandments? I mean, there are always prohibitions against stealing, lying, using people as means only.
Aren't they oftentimes though very different for different reasons and with different underlying values.
Well, you put it the other way around. You say those are what is underlying, and they're the conditions of living together at all. I mean, it's very interesting to take a revolutionary situation. A group seeking to overthrow the present society and the present government will do all it can to promote chaos, to destabilize, to make it impossible for that society to function. What happens if the guerrillas succeed to overthrow it? You immediately try to establish a moral as well as political order. You immediately stipulate that this feeling that we've just been promoting all along in the revolution has got to come to a stop. And there will be no more killing, and there will be no more squealing on your neighbors. Everything that they said needs to happen in order to overthrow the unjust regime is turned around. Why? Is that simply a double standard? No. It's because those are the requisites for living together at all. And you can't have a situation of perpetual chaos. So I think, Janet, you could say that there are some fundamental obligations, and those are at the base, rather than being subject to kind of cultural and moral relativism. But it still is a serious question of whether there is, or what those are, and can you stipulate them.
What other fatal flaws are there?
Well, consequences ethics gets at some of that. If you say it's always wrong to, it's wrong to steal or wrong to lie or to commit adultery or bear false witness, etc., the consequence of ethics persons would say, well, what are the consequences? If is it right to keep marriage vows, if to stay together till death us do part, if two people are destroying each other in their relationship? Is it right to keep one's commitments to the Shah if the Shah is using the benefits of that commitment to oppress millions? During the Vietnam War, we asked, how long do we need to keep our commitment to the Saigon government in the light of gruesome consequences? Bonhoeffer was absolutely aghast at Immanuel Kant's insistence that we never tell a lie because truth-telling had to exist as unconditional. And Bonhoeffer says, if someone comes to your door and asks, if a Nazi comes to your door and asks, are there any Jews here? You don't say, there are Jews here. If there are Jews here, you say, no, there are no Jews here. Now, the duty ethics person, as I said before, doesn't say there are never any exceptions, but it becomes very difficult for that person to say, on what grounds do you make the exception? You can do it. You say it's fundamentally in conflict with some other obligation. But you end up with some crazy kind of pharisaic, in the bad sense of the word, distinctions. In Lest Innocent Blood Be Shed, the folks at La Chambon said, if asked, never lie. But if they don't ask, don't offer to tell the truth. So if they ask, are there any Jews here, you have to say, yes, there are Jews here. But if they don't ask, are there Jews here, don't offer to say that there are Jews here. The case of the false identity cards, it was all right to make false identity cards, but then if they asked if those were false identity cards, you had to say, yes, they were false identity cards. So the duty ethics person has a terrifically hard time with the whole question of exceptions and with conflict of fundamental obligations. The consequentialist ethics person has a way of dealing with that. You want to just stop? What about character ethics? Strengths and weaknesses of that.
some of the same problems of consequence.
Yeah, sure. How do you predict what the consequences for character will be? How a decision and action will in fact affect the kinds of society that you desire? Jean?
I was wondering about that. What about if, you know, different characters of different people
would
conflict?
Yeah.
Like, what if
they... Yeah. Stipulating desirable character is a task in itself, and then you have conflicting characters and the choices among them, and conflicting qualities of the society, which to choose.
And see, that has so much potential for being oppressive to people who do not have power and therefore are normative, and, you know, the whole thing of models,
yeah.
Gender models, this
yeah.
is the way the ideal man should be,
yeah.
the ideal woman should be, all that kind of stuff, and
yeah.
it's very oppressive if people don't recognize
diversity. Yeah.
It'd be very liberating, too. Just in the fact that it focuses on individuals rather than massing people together as a mass, as a unit. How is this going to affect, you know, different than consequence ethics, in that it does focus on individual character, it can focus also on the character of a society, but at least as far as I see it, it can also very much focus on the individual rather than linking them together in a mass.
As long as there's allowance in the character for diversity, I mean.
Well, yeah.
Otherwise, you're focusing on an individual to make that individual into a carbon copy of a perfect individual.
Yeah.
I mean, we all turn out to be the American man, and all women turn out to be some American woman, kind of thing. Right?
I think the character ethics will allow for diversity. I think
it can.
Yeah. Is there an assumption that there is an ideal character?
No, there isn't. But there isn't that. You don't have to carry that, but you certainly do have to make some choices about better and worse qualities of character. But it doesn't have to carry a particular picture any more than duty ethics persons has to line up with a particular set or consequences ethics says. They're the same norms to decide what are good consequences. I hope you see that the mode of decision making affects the decision. I mean, just the structure of it, even when you have lots of variety within each. Jean?
I was just wondering, you said before that the consequential
yeah.
is sort of the predominant one in America.
Yeah.
I was wondering if this one might be catching up. I mean, it just seems like there's a real emphasis on personal growth, and you know, what enhances the individual's growth, the person, and what is ethical.
It's been very interesting of late, and I point you back to the handout of Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, in which she's arguing that we've abandoned in American culture attention to moral character. She starts out with those examples of Watergate and etc. And then she says that even the far right, we religious right, we may not like them, but at least they understand the subject is important. And then she goes on to say, why have liberals left everything about moral character up to individual preferences rather than a concerted effort to develop a particular, or a certain, to develop moral character consciously? It's very interesting, because the last few editions of, what's the name of the magazine, put out by the National, by the Education Department, Health, Education, and Welfare, or Health and Human Services, what, the Education magazine for the official government, Bureau of Education, has been on moral education. That was unthinkable in this society for 20 years before that. To say, how ought public schools be teaching moral values for the sake of shaping moral character is something now, or take a look at all the materials in Christian education on moral development. We had a series of moral development, not just materials for teaching Sunday school classes. All of that is because of an increased attention to moral character. Yeah. Okay, now think about what your method is.
pros and cons, and if it's some kind of combination.